Support for Iditapod, a production of Alaska Public Media, comes from MVFCU. Experience the MVFCU way.
They just look annoyed.
Yep. What? That was dogs, I guess?
That was us trying to get the dogs to harmonize, but they didn't want to.
Okay, I see. Welcome to the Iditapod, a podcast about, what else, the Iditarod. I'm your host, Casey Grove. Welcome to the first episode of Season 3.
The Iditapod is a production of Alaska Public Media and KNOM Radio in Nome. Find more race coverage at alaskapublic.org and knom.org.
And to start this year, we're doing something a little different. Call it a prequel if you want to. We want to try to explain to people who might not know a lot about dog mushing or the Iditarod or even Alaska what the fuss is all about. So we're going to be talking about the history of the race and the history of dog mushing in general. That, in a way, is also a history of modern Alaska. And to do that, I'm joined by Alaska Public Media reporter Zachariah Hughes. Hi, Zach.
Hello, Casey Grove.
Zach, first, what are we talking about on this podcast anyway?
Well, in general, the Iditapod is a comprehensive coverage of the Iditarod. And what we mean by that is everything from, you know, news of the day, fast-breaking race developments, as we're able to cover them, all the way down to kind of weird stories that happen in remote parts of Alaska for the 1.5-2 weeks that the race is happening. So in general, we're going to be giving analysis about what's playing out at the front of the pack, conditions along the trail. But we also like to find weirder stories, whether that's a wood bison trapping a musher on the trail and making things impassable for a while, to old moose hunters in places like Takotna explaining where the moose that's feeding the mushers came from at a potluck. So that's generally what we like to do here. Today, I want to talk about the history of dog mushing and how that relates to the history of the Iditarod as a race, and then also cover what happened last year in the Iditarod so we get a little bit of a refresher.
And real quick, Zach, your credentials. You've covered the Iditarod the last 3 years. You're getting ready to go out in your fourth. I've covered it a couple of times. Zach, you must be really anticipating the race starting here pretty soon.
Yeah, it's not far off. The race kicks off on the first Saturday in March and lasts about 9 days, 10 days until a winner arrives. The last musher is generally in and attending the wrap-up banquet within about 2 weeks of the start. So really the first half of March is just dogs.
And we'll be doing a couple podcasts here in the beginning, and then we'll switch over to daily podcasts during the race. I'll be here hosting that. Before all of that, though, if you're someone who knows nothing about dog mushing, doesn't even know why someone would be interested in it, let alone spend inordinate amounts of time and money training to actually do it, why should you care about this, Zach?
Good question. One I have had to explain to my parents in Connecticut several times. And there's a couple reasons. I mean, one is this is kind of the closest Alaska has to professional or major league sports. And so if you're a resident of the state, you're sort of inundated with this long dog race. It's general news here. And dog mushing is the state's sport. So that's one part of it. I mean, it's a pretty unique endurance sport. There's not many marathons that involve aspects of husbandry and weather and different geography and stuff like that. So it's really unique as a way of people pushing boundaries, testing themselves, testing weather, testing kind of mental fortitude, which particularly in the second half of a race when people have slept maybe, you know, a dozen hours in the course of several days really starts to be a factor. And the last reason is this is one of the only events that brings the whole state together. There's not a lot of occasions where folks in Anchorage and South Central Alaska are in any kind of dialogue with folks along the Yukon River in the interior, out along the Bering Sea coast. So it's a pretty interesting way that Alaska remembers its history, celebrates its mythology, and participates.
And then there's just the dogs. People like dogs. They like seeing dogs with jobs, even. This involves wilderness travel and across great distances and kind of links back to a time in the past where that was the best way to get around. So what makes more sense here to talk about first, the history of the Iditarod as a race or the history of dog mushing itself?
Let's cover the, let me just mention the history of the race because that's a little bit easier. The Iditarod sled dog race starts in 1973 after several years of people bandying about the idea of having a kind of cross Alaska run, and it takes a while for logistics to get figured out. It came at a time in the early 70s when Alaska was at this really pivotal point. It was right before oil started coming down the Trans-Alaska pipeline, and oil wealth really transformed the state, you know, both its identity, its finances, its politics. It was also at a point when a lot of people in Alaska were becoming more reliant on snow machines and mechanized travel for getting around. And husbandry, you know, working dogs for transport and working dogs for freighting materials was really falling out of fashion. And so the Iditarod was conceived of as a way of remembering the state's history and trying to revitalize dog mushing by bringing a focus to this high-profile event.
And I think a lot of people outside Alaska will point to the Serum Run to Nome in 1925. Tell me about that. Why is that the part of the race that a lot of people remember?
The 73 Iditarod and every Iditarod since is very wrapped up in the mythology of the 1925 Serum Run. What happened was Nome is a gold town. There was a strike and a stampede at the very end of the 19th century. By 1925, the town's really shrunk. Gold is not that much of a factor, but it's still a major population center for rural Western Alaska. And there was a diphtheria outbreak. Doctors in Nome warned that there wasn't enough serum, and they were able to get a message out about a pending catastrophe that had the potential to just wreak devastation not only on the town of Nome, but the region at large. So territorial leaders at the time were trying to figure out how can we get a serum to prevent this outbreak to Nome. They were having to get it from Seattle. And, you know, this is at the cusp of airplanes really transforming how people get around Alaska. This was in the dead of winter. It was late January, February. On top of that, it was a record cold winter. And there was just a concern that if they tried to get a plane to Nome, it would crash with the only serum that was on hand going down with it. Planes were not at a point where they could deal with that kind of cold reliably. And so it was decided that the most reliable, fastest way to get this vital medicine to Nome was by teams of dog sledders running in relays, 30, 40, 50 mile chunks. So the serum was brought up by railroad to the town of Nenana, and that was kind of the closest point. And then what came next was a really heroic 600 and some odd mile run from Nenana to Nome in stages, crossing the interior, the Yukon River, the Bering Sea coast, all the way to Nome.
They did it in 5.5 days. I mean, this is extraordinary. 5.5 days to go 684 miles. Extraordinary, extraordinary.
And back in those days, just about every family would have a dog team in their village to get around, to get firewood, to just do the kind of things you need to do, and that's your main form of transportation. So that guy, the best musher in your village, was the guy that was on that leg of the serum run, right?
Yeah, it was folks that just, you know, were willing to deal with 30, 40, 50 below and blizzards and winds all at the same time to get medicine.
Save a bunch of people. A lot of good guys and a lot of good dogs out there.
Yeah, a lot of good boys.
A lot of good boys.
You know, what I think is important to mention is that by 1925, dog sledding was already becoming less vital than it had been. I mean, as airplanes start to come in, as mechanized farm equipment like tractors in the Arctic were beginning to be used for transport, even the railroad, the serum was carried by rail all the way to Nenana. So these forms of transportation were starting to transform logistics in Alaska and with it, the culture. Alaska was dramatically transformed as the result of gold strikes and gold rushes around the state, starting in 1880 in southeast Alaska, all the way up through 1900 on the Bering Sea coast, through the interior and the recent Fairbanks, your hometown.
That's right.
Kind of developed as spillover from the Yukon gold rush in the Canadian territory.
People even said that they saw the same dogs in Fairbanks that they had seen in Dawson.
Well, and that's probably true. I mean, there were, you know, it was a lot of the same people just kind of migrating to gold camps, sometimes because they had, you know, not been successful in the Yukon, they went to Nome. And if they weren't successful in Nome, they maybe went to Fairbanks afterwards. But, you know, all over the state were these little gold outposts. And people were basically stealing dogs because that was one of the most reliable ways to get around. So in San Francisco and Seattle, dogs were stolen off the street and barged up to Alaska and resold because that was how passengers moved around. That was how goods were freighted around. That was how mail was transported around. You know, you think about territorial Alaska, one of the only government services that reached a lot of people was the mail. And there were these contracts for mushers to carry mail. And a lot of the routes that the Iditarod sled dog race traces today were originally mail and freight routes where carriers would move stuff between roadhouses, kind of dropping off mail to different outposts.
So there was a time where many families in Alaska would have had dog teams, and it's sort of romanticized in, you know, thinking back to the Serum Run, and then now we've got the Iditarod, the race. But this was a form of transportation that was developed over hundreds of years. The dogs themselves developed over hundreds of years. So what was mushing dogs like before the Serum Run?
How far back do you want to go?
Oh, geez. Give me the quick version of where dog mushing even came from.
Okay, well, around 12,000 years ago, humans migrated. Okay. Those are the earliest records of dogs cohabitating with humans. Several thousand years ago, we have evidence of human migration into Alaska by indigenous Arctic-dwelling people. And there are a lot of really early records of husbandry taking off from that period onward. Dogs were used as draft animals, much the same way that you know, draft horses and mules have been used. They helped carry weight. And in the winter, sleds were attached and dogs, several dogs might be lashed together with hunter or the dog's owner out in front of them, stomping down trail. This was not a fast way to get around. It was not racing. It was just kind of for moving animal carcasses, for moving equipments and supplies as people migrated. So how we get from draft animals to this kind of racing as a sport with a system of rules, that really happens in the early part of the 20th century. Now, that's not to say people didn't race dogs before that. There have probably been people racing their dog teams for as long as there have been dog teams.
It's just fun to do.
It's fun to do. I've never seen anybody even venture to claim that they can say when the first sled dog race happened. That said, in 1908, we know that the first All-Alaska sweepstakes happened. A lot of the sort of big names from the Serum Run were in Nome at that point. And, you know, they had had animals that were helping with transport, with moving humans, with moving gold, with moving supplies, and they start racing dogs. And from this, we get the early system of rules that really started to evolve into formal sled dog racing. And within a couple of years, it had expanded beyond the Seward Peninsula and Nome into Alaska. After that, it spread to the lower 48, which I didn't know that much about, but you have kennel clubs popping up all over the United States, including, you know, the upper Midwest and New England. And I went back and I found some tape of, you know, like an early documentary about dog sleds in New Hampshire.
The sled dogs are frequent visitors to the inns of New England in winter. Of course, these friendly animals are a great favorite among the guests who admire them for their handsome appearance and affectionate disposition.
And mushing and sled dog racing and this kind of national enthusiasm in the lower 48, it really kind of has its golden age, you know, after the Alaska sweepstakes in 1908 and through about the interwar period. And one of the things that changes it is that in World War I and in World War II, a lot of young men are taken from Alaska to go serve overseas. A lot of, you know, in the Alaska Territory, a lot of young men and families and women are mobilized for war and put on war footing. And actually, a lot of dogs were taken from the U.S. to help serve. I mean, do things like drag ordnance and drag supplies into the mountains. There's actually a This American Life story from a few years ago about the kind of war service animals.
Equine, Semper Fido. So our show today is about animal sacrifice, and of course there are times when we ask animals to make the ultimate sacrifice.
World War II changes Alaska dramatically, you know, in large part because afterwards there's this incredibly large buildup of U.S. military forces in Alaska. A lot of infrastructure begins to change, a lot more people and the kinds of people that are pulled in really changes the state. And, you know, statehood happens in 1959. And a lot of those changes we mentioned earlier get us to the point in 1973 when dog mushing has begun to really ebb.
How has the race itself changed dog mushing? How have the dogs themselves changed over the course of the Iditarod?
A lot. The stocks of dogs that Alaska Native people, indigenous people had bred were really working animals. And over hundreds, thousands of years, they had been bred specifically for survival in a really challenging Arctic environment. Thick top coats, undercoats, really efficient metabolisms, generally bigger animals that were really good at hauling. From 1973 until today, the evolution of the sled dog has really been one of refining a lot of characteristics to make them better at long-distance racing. So smaller dogs that are faster. For the last 100 years, since a lot of the gold strikes in Alaska, when more dogs were being introduced into the state, the bloodlines have really diversified. A lot of different breeds have been introduced. So those, you know, what were once maybe purebred Malamutes from the Bering Strait area, the Bering Sea coast, those have really been kind of offset with more hounds, shorter haired dogs, spaniels even. I mean, there's just a lot of, that's how you get the purebred Alaskan Husky, which is sort of a joke because Alaskan Huskies are known to be an amalgamation of different breeds. And the Iditarod and I think long-distance mushing in general have really pushed the bounds of trying to breed selectively to create a more efficient long-range racing dog.
And so we want to talk a little bit about the history of last year's race. As we were going into the race, we were talking about some dark clouds hanging over the Iditarod. As there have been threats to dog mushing itself, there have also been threats to the race that is trying to keep dog mushing alive. What were those?
There were multiple kind of issues or scandals or disagreements last year. The biggest one, probably the highest profile, was that one of the sports star athletes, Dallas Seavey, had said he was not going to race because of all of the fallout from a doping scandal. The year earlier, Dallas's team had tested positive for a banned substance, a painkiller called tramadol. This would be a major thing. Dallas Seavey denied that he'd given his dogs that. A lot of people came to his defense. And based on how it was handled, he had said that the Iditarod's governing body, the board, had really mishandled this. And he said he wasn't going to race. He went to Norway to race in a prominent race over there instead. This would be sort of like, I don't like a sports like top athlete like Michael Jordan.
It'd be like if James Harden was going to sit out the entire NBA season, something like that. One of the stars not there to attract his fans to this sport.
James Harden is a basketball player?
He's a basketball instructor.
Yeah, so it'd be like James Harden says, I'm not going to play for the Toronto Raptors or whatever team he's on, you know, because of how things have been handled. So that was one scandal. The second was a lot of mushers were really upset with how the Iditarod's governing body was conducting itself, saying that there were conflicts of interest on the board, disagreeing with some of the rule changes that had happened.
It seemed like a lot of this stuff was sort of like a sled dog race that had gotten bigger and bigger and bigger over the years and started to have to deal with some very complicated issues from that. There was also a report, right, that came out that was leaked.
Yeah, there was a report that looked at the financials of the race and said that the outlook didn't look good for the Iditarod, that sponsors were really leaving. That was cited as a major reason, and a lot of mistrust of the organization among mushers was another big reason. And the way that it came out, it just made it look like the Iditarod's financial health was not particularly promising.
And they've made some changes since then, and we're going to get more into that sort of stuff. So the race starts with these clouds hanging over it, and then there's all this attention on it, and then what happens?
And then you don't really hear a lot about it.
Because there's a race happening.
Because there's a race happening, and surprise, surprise, the mushers don't really want to talk about their attitudes towards sponsors leaving the race in the middle of said race.
Or Dallas CV.
Yeah, people are busy racing. I will say that in a lot of kind of casual conversations at different checkpoints that I was having with people, there was a kind of a negative attitude about how stuff was going. It definitely felt like there was a shadow over a lot of things. People were just kind of saying stuff like that this just wasn't as fun as it used to be. What you mentioned with of this kind of weird race getting a little bit bigger than anyone anticipated, I think that's really where a lot of the tension is, you know, how do you have a group of sort of rough and tumble mushers and trail breakers who suddenly have to juggle large budgets and formal rules processes and national attention and national scrutiny on what you really did used to be, you know, a kind of neighborly collection of weirdos who all loved doing the same thing.
How did the race itself play out? There wasn't a champion named CV last year.
For the first time since 2011, last year's race saw a non-CV win. So the winner was 31-year-old Jorli Smith Olsem from Norway originally. Really, I think the kind of top items from last year were that we had a really tight three-way race among Mitch CV, Nicholas Petit, and Jor Olsem, all really kind of gunning for first place and in a really tight competition among themselves. The other thing was weather. It was a rough run. It was a slower race than a lot of other years. And it felt like there was just bad weather systems just following the front of the pack. That was actually one of the things that Jor, in an interview just after his victory, said was one of the most kind of relevant factors in that year's race.
It was a slow trail, a soft trail. We had wind, and it was just every leg was more challenging than the other, I felt like.
So that was a big part, was weather. The other was trail conditions. It was just kind of much deeper snow. Frankly, you know, we have deeper snow because it was a better winter than in a lot of recent years. And so Mitch CV actually said that was one of the things that ended up being an obstacle for his team. They had been training in shallower snow, and so suddenly when dogs have deeper snow, they've got to work harder to kind of get their legs moving, more susceptible to some injuries. And so for his team that had been training and is really groomed for a faster, more packed down trail, that was a serious kind of wrench thrown into his plan.
I don't think I've gone that slow with a dog team in 15 years. We've been training to go faster and faster, and suddenly 6 miles an hour was the norm, and I had a hard time getting my head around that it's okay to go 6 miles an hour, but the dogs were happy with it, they were fine, so it worked out.
What I would say was last year, for long stretches, it was just a slog. And, you know, it's an endurance wilderness race. Like, of course it's going to be hard, but hearing even folks like Mitch CV, who's like, tough as nails, I think it's safe to say, talk about, you know, what a difficult trail it was. I mean, that's something that really, you know, that sticks.
And weather is always going to be an issue. There was this one particular storm that came in and people were making decisions about where to take their 24-hour rest. That kind of factored into where the top three, four mushers ended up late in the race. But then there was this other thing that happened that kind of determined who won the race.
Yeah. So last year, Nicholas Petit was in the lead and was poised to probably win heading out of Unalakleet. But after Shaq Tulik, heading into Koyuk, his team went through a ground storm and he lost the trail. You know, it was whiteout conditions. Trail markers, in his telling, were not very close together. He had some problems with his GPS tracking unit and he lost the trail.
I heard about open water before the race and I wasn't going to go seek the trail out too far to the west. So I looked to the west a little bit, didn't see anything, went east, figured maybe I'll find that overland trail they talked about. I got to the place on the GPS, it says there's a trail, but I did loops and there's no trail where there's a trail on the GPS. So then I turned them around, G'd them around, and potted them around, and went back where same direction I came from, just still looking for a trail. Eventually I saw a trail marker, got on that trail, and this is how few trail markers there were. I get back on that trail. On one side, I see a trail marker way far, way out there. On the other side, you don't see one. You probably should be able to see a couple trail markers.
So as that's happening, and as it turns out, he was lost and trying to find his way back to the trail, Jor Olsem zooms past, manages to stay on the trail, and takes a lead that he then does not let go of for the remainder of the race. Nick Petit did eventually close in on that, and he actually arrived with more dogs, having posted much faster runs than Jor for some of the end.
We will have more information coming up about the trail, who's in the race this year, and what more to expect from the Iditarod and the Iditapod.
One thing I'm really excited about is Ben Matheson is returning to the Iditapod. He'll be covering the trail. He and I will be sharing trail responsibilities. Ben was one of the reporters on our first season, and we're very excited to have him back. We'll also have some contributions from others as well. But I think this is going to be a good Iditapod.
Yeah, I'm excited too. Speaking of contributions from others, we are again soliciting questions from our listeners. It's one of the best parts of the Iditapod, in my opinion.
Yeah, let us know what you want to know. We love questions. You can email us and just type out the text, or better yet, we want to use your voice. We like the medium of sound. And so if you have a smartphone, you can record yourself either on a voice memo app or however you want and email us. It's the same email. It's iditarod@alaskapublic.org. And we want to hear what you're curious about, what you want to know.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Zachariah Hughes from Alaska Public Media for joining me here. Zach.
Casey.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Please stay tuned for our next Iditapod episode. That'll be coming up here soon, and then we will switch over to daily episodes when the race starts. You can subscribe to the Iditapod at iTunes and other podcatcher apps, or listen online at alaskapublic.org. Our theme music is by the band Sassafras. I'm Casey Grove. Catch you next time, and until then, happy trails.
If you can't handle me at my shouting voice, you don't deserve me at my radio voice.
That's better.